From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. New Hampshire has long had a connection with space exploration, starting with astronaut Alan Shepard of Derry, who was the first American to travel in space and one of only 12 people to walk on the moon. The connection continues with Concord's Krista McAuliffe, whose dream of being the nation's first teacher in space ended tragically when the shuttle Challenger exploded 35 years ago today. It was a terrible day that many Granite Staters still remember, but McAuliffe was a passionate educator, and that legacy lives on as new generations tackle space science in our schools, colleges, and universities. Today in The Exchange, we honor McAuliffe's memory by looking at what projects New Hampshire scientists, educators, and students are working on. And listeners, let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And our phone number, 800-892-6477. Again, 800-892-6477. So we begin the hour with Phil Brown. He's a former K-12 Concord science teacher who co-founded a project called Forest Watch, inspired by McAuliffe, who was his friend and colleague. Welcome, Phil. Good to have you on the show today.
Good morning, Laura, and thank you for having me on, and thank you for paying tribute to the Challenger astronauts.
We hear from everybody, Phil, that Krista McAuliffe was a passionate educator. I'd like your memories of that. What was she like as a teacher?
Well, I have to tell you that I was actually never a teacher with her. I was actually a contestant in the Teacher in Space program, and she and I were competing for the opportunity to represent New Hampshire in the national competition. So I actually only met her one time, the day that we had our finalist interviews. And obviously she had, as in NASA parlance, they would say, the right stuff, because she not only moved on past me and the other finalists from New Hampshire, but the other 113 finalists at the national level with NASA as well.
Well, and just for younger listeners who, or newcomers to the state, who may not remember what this was all about, Phil, this was under the, correct me if I'm wrong, the first Bush administration, right? And they thought that it would revive students' interest in space exploration to have a teacher in space.
Well, you are wrong. I hate to tell you that, Laura.
Okay.
It's never happened before, but it was actually under the Reagan administration.
Okay.
And Reagan in 1984 announced that there would be a teacher in space because there had been a number, at that time there were 20 successful shuttle launches, and everyone assumed it was just like a walk in the park. And so they decided to have a teacher represent the first civilian in space. And Krista, her dream, she had taught American women. She introduced a course in 1983 at Concord High called American Women. And she wanted to show that ordinary people, especially women, could have a lasting impact in our society. And that philosophy, I think, is what propelled her through the ranks of all the finalists and allowed her to be selected as the teacher in space.
So you mentioned that, you know, at the time there had been a lot of shuttles going up. It had become routine. So President Reagan, and I stand corrected there, said, hey, let's do this. It caught on, lots of enthusiasm, lots of teachers saying, yes, I want to go. Then we have this tragedy, Phil. The shuttle explodes. 7 astronauts, including Krista McAuliffe, die. How did that affect people's views of whether space exploration was worth it?
Well, at NASA, I have to tell you, there was a hiatus there that at first they didn't know whether they'd ever recover from it. But then they rallied and decided that they could retool the solid rocket boosters that caused the original problem and move on. But it took a number of years for the NASA administration to begin to recognize that we could launch again safely with people. And they never really did have a teacher in space program. They did have NASA educator astronauts in the early aughts, 2000s. Barbara Morgan, who was Krista's backup, eventually did fly as a mission specialist, but the teacher in space lessons that Krista was going to teach, and her basic idea was she was just going to keep a journal and talk about what it was like to be an ordinary person in space. And so that never came to fruition. And that's where, when she was lost, I decided that it was a very important thing that we try and figure out a way to honor that legacy of involving children in the space program. And that's how Forth Watch and the other programs that Barry Rock and I at the University of New Hampshire work so hard to achieve. So.
Well, and let's talk about that. And that is how we here on the Exchange decided to observe this day. We have done prior shows looking at what happened, looking at McAuliffe and what she hoped to do. So today, that is exactly how we're trying to approach this, sober anniversary. So let's talk about that, Phil. As you said, McAuliffe partly inspired you to create something called Forest Watch. So what was Forest Watch?
Well, Forest Watch grew out of my awareness. I had taken a two-week NASA workshop in 1986, where I learned for the first time about global climate change. And it was the first year in 300,000 years that the concentration of carbon dioxide overwrought 350 parts per million. In other words, it rose higher than it had ever been for 300,000 years. And at the same time, there was a whole host of satellites that were being deployed into space to monitor change over time in the Earth. And I also learned at the time that in order to validate those satellite findings, that people had to ground truth. You actually had to go to a spot on the ground where the satellite was showing change and collect samples and determine whether or not the change was real. And so I thought, this is the perfect way. It didn't risk any lives. I could get students involved because it wasn't rocket science. It was just collecting samples and doing a number of fairly simplistic scientific activities to validate what the satellite was showing. And so I wrote lots of letters, and eventually Barry Rock answered one of those letters and said, let's try it out. And so he and I started working together with just my students at Concord High. After I moved to Concord High from Goffstown, where I had been. And eventually, we brought six other schools on board, and we called it Forest Watch. And in essence, what we did was we monitored the effects of smog on white pine, which was a tree that was right outside the door of literally every school in New England. And students were taught, if the technology was available, how to look at their satellite image, because every school was given a Landsat satellite image of the area where their pine trees were located. And they would collect samples, some of which would go to UNH for analysis, and some of which they would keep in school for analysis. And the data was collected and every year analyzed in conjunction with the levels of ozone that were being recorded at Concord and elsewhere in the state. And they were in lockstep. As the white pine trees got healthier, the students' data showed that they were getting healthier. The satellite image data showed that they were getting healthier. The analysis that the University of New Hampshire was doing at the same time the students were doing showed that everything was exactly the same way, and we were doing the ground truthing.
And wow. So that must have been really interesting for students. You know, there's the satellite up in the sky, but I'm going to triple check here on the ground that it is collecting right data and looking at the impact on our white pine trees, which, of course, we all love. What was the most important thing that was discovered from Forest Watch, Phil? What do you think?
I would say the most important thing that was discovered from Forest Watch was that teachers gained the confidence that they could do authentic science with their students, and that this authentic science actually meant something, because the data was published every year by the University of New Hampshire. And there were groups of students that Barry was able to actually take to international meetings where they actually presented the findings that the Forest Watch program is showing.
And, wow, hands-on science at work.
And not only
that's exciting for young people.
Correct. And not only that's
exciting for anybody.
There were spin-offs. The University of New Hampshire started Project SMART using the same basic authentic science assessment, which was a 3-week summer program that brought students from all over the state. They studied terrestrial and aquatic ecology. They studied space science. They studied biotechnology. It gave rise to what was called World Ocean Watch, another program that Barry and I started down in Florida, looking at mangrove keys. And it ultimately gave rise to probably the largest authentic science student program called GLOBE, when then Vice President Al Gore heard about Barry's work at UNH and asked him to be the first senior scientist for the Global Learning and Observations to Benefit the Environment program.
Well, and partly all inspired by, you know, your experience with Krista McAuliffe. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about today. You know, the legacy that McAuliffe left of learning and being passionate about space science. And we're going to hear from lots of teachers and professors who are working with students on all types of projects, including some being used by NASA. So, Phil Brown, for now, we will let you go, but we really appreciate you being with us. Thank you.
And thank you again, Laura. And just one last thing. Krista is buried at Blossom Hill Cemetery, the top of Blossom Hill Cemetery. And it's a beautiful site that looks out over the Merrimack Valley, and a beautiful epitaph from her husband, Stephen. And I would suggest that everyone should take a visit up there.
All right. Phil, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye now.
That's Phil Brown, former Concord science teacher who co-founded a project that he told us about called Forest Watch. He also founded SOS, which stands for Success on STEAM. Exchange listeners, join us as we explore the space science and education happening in our state right now, including projects of national scope. What questions do you have about this current generation of both professors and students and what they're working on? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 800-892-6477. Well, with us now from the University of New Hampshire are Nathan Schwadron, professor of physics with the UNH Space Science Center. Nathan, welcome. Good to have you.
Thank you. Hello, Laura. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Noé Lugaz, Research Associate Professor of Physics. And Noé, thank you for being with us as well.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Well, and Nathan, a couple questions for you first. We just heard just some beautiful recollections from Phil Brown there about Krista McAuliffe. Did you have any connections with her or her work?
Very loosely, but I was in high school. I was a senior in high school when the disaster happened. I remembered it. It was an unreal event. It took me weeks to really believe what I saw was real. You know, we had, at the time, it seemed like the NASA program was just infallible. And so that it you know, that took a long time to recover from. Remarkably, throughout my career in many, many different places, I've ended up working on issues related in one way or another to the dangers of the space environment. In college, I studied, in undergraduate, I studied devices, electronic devices called MOSFETs, which are get radiation damage. So we're trying to figure out how to have them get less radiation damage. But astronauts are exposed to these same dangers of space. And throughout my career, I've continued to work in the space environment, understanding the solar wind and, you know, the many hazards that we have as we develop geospace technologies and we make more and more use of space. So it's really, it's kind of been an arc that's connected my entire career. Krista McAuliffe, you know, in many ways, she was just years ahead of her time, because we're starting to see the emergence of space tourism now. And I think the connection of not just, you know, special people going into space, but everyone having access to space, I think Krista opened the door to that. And more importantly, it's, you know, our connection with technology and science. It's deeply important that we understand how reliant we are onto it, onto these tools, but also really a part, every human being is really a part of the infrastructure that we have.
I want to ask about one project that you mentioned, Nathan, and that is looking at solar winds and the solar cycles. Why is it so important to all of us to understand what's going on out there with, if I could call it, solar weather?
Yeah, well, the truth is that, you know, throughout the space age, as we started to send satellites into space, we've learned about how hazardous the environment is. Every year we lose satellites as a result of storms that happen in space. Very high energy particles come from the sun, they come from the galaxy, they end up affecting electronic equipment, and we lose satellites as a result. Now, of course, human beings are subject to those same hazards. So, you know, I view it as a sort of like the ocean. If you're going to navigate the ocean, you better know about the weather, and you better understand how that weather leads to hazards on the seas. If you're going to navigate space, if you're going to make use of space, you better understand how the sun becomes violent very often, and creates hazards. You also have to understand the environment of the galaxy that leaks into our solar system and exposes us to very high levels of radiation. And it turns out actually that the origins of life on the planet itself, on Earth itself, is actually linked in fundamental ways to the environment of space. So there's many reasons for it. There's also a connection to, you know, what we're studying in terms of climate change. And that gets more complicated, but you know, the systems that we see are all interlinked, and we really have to understand the various drives, the pushes and drives from the sun, from the galaxy.
Well, I love the analogy. You know, if you're going to travel the ocean, you need to know the weather. Same thing with outer space. You also mentioned galactic cosmic rays, Nathan. What are galactic cosmic rays? Are they related in any way to, you know, solar flares, or is it something completely different? Because I know you're working on that too.
They're related. Galactic cosmic rays are the very highest energy particles that we see within the galaxy. And these particles come from outside of our solar system, and they come into our solar system. And you know, they essentially can get through most materials. You have to have, you know, an enormous amount of shielding before you can actually shield completely against galactic cosmic rays. So we see you know, hadron showers here on Earth from these particles, but when we're in space, they you know, they penetrate the hulls of spacecraft and create other forms of radiation. Those then go into human bodies and electronic equipment. So it's just a huge hazard. It's around all the time, and it makes it very difficult for people to spend lots of time in space, because eventually
damage
from galactic cosmic rays causes radiation damage that leads to cancers.
Oh wow! So this is really important as NASA starts looking at, you know, human travel to Mars. You have to watch out for those galactic cosmic rays. They could, you know, sicken you, kill you, or ruin your spacecraft, Nathan. That seems to be what you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anything involving long duration trips in space. But, you know, the other thing too is that, you know, people, as we have astronauts who spend many, many days in space, even relatively close to Earth, we have to worry about that too. And believe it or not, we also have to worry about it in terms of airline travel. And we know that, you know, airlines are making use of higher and higher routes. And as they do that, they are exposing the crews and the passengers to higher and higher levels of radiation. So it's really a systemic problem that we really have to understand, and understand what we're exposing. You know,
wow. That's the first time I've heard that, Nathan. Sorry to interrupt. So if you are a frequent flyer or a flight attendant or a pilot, you need to know about this.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Talk a little bit, Nathan, please, just briefly, and then I'll turn to Noé, about the involvement of students in these projects. The Parker Space Probe near the Sun, for example. Go ahead.
Yeah, students are critical. I mean, what we're seeing right now is a complete growth in space industry because of how important the tools that we're using are. So, you know, our students that we train become the next people who work within these fields. And if we don't train the students, we're not going to, these fields will not survive. So it's absolutely critical that we bring students in into this. I think that that's true of people coming into the industry. It's also true, you know, I have other courses that I teach in which just exposing anyone going into any field to what we see in the sky, how we understand our universe is absolutely critical, because it really is through those types of studies that we understand the origin of science as a whole.
Wow, and perfect segue to Noé and your work. You are working with NASA to create a bigger pool of people who are involved in this type of research. So just tell us how your work, first of all, intersects with what Nathan is doing. Noé, please.
Sure. So, I mean, my background is very similar to Nathan. So I'm also studying this space weather and space radiation. But in terms of the student involvement, it's really what Nathan described is traditionally things have been done, which is we involve students as much as we can in projects. But that project, the IMAP student collaboration I'm leading, we're kind of trying to turn this around. So instead of trying to involve students as much as possible, we're just creating a project from scratch, really just for the students. And that's something that NASA has just started doing maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, is saying, well, when we do one of these big missions, this, you know, $500 million, $1 billion mission, we're going to give 1% to just kind of make sure we train students not only on as much as possible, but train them in all aspects of a mission life. And I think what's really unique about this project I'm doing is we are trying to get students involved in things that they don't usually do, which is designing a mission, not just building instrument or analyzing data, but also going before that, thinking, okay, if I want to do that type of science, how can I do this with a mission? Let's go on the paper and just think, okay, I need that type of instrument or that type of orbit. So I'm trying to go at the very first stage that will be very useful later on in the career, is how to design a mission, how to make requirements and things like this.
And tell us more, Noé, please, about the students who are involved in these projects, because it's more than just at UNH.
Yeah, very much. So this particular project is a collaboration between three universities, UNH, University, Sonoma State University in Northern California, and Howard University in DC, which we all know these days because that's the alma mater of our vice president. The number of universities doing space program is relatively low, and typically is students involved in space program is not very diverse, sadly. So part of this program really is to kind of increase the diversity of universities and then naturally of students that come into space or get interested in the space. And really what we're trying to do also is involving students at the undergraduate level primarily, because again, a lot of the science we do is somewhat high level. And so many times we tend to involve graduate students mostly, especially in kind of hardware projects. So here we try to involve undergrad students from three different universities, have them work together, which was made quite harder by the fact that I never met my students and I never met any of the other students due to COVID. We're pre-doing this online right now, which really is a challenge in itself. But you know, we have about 15 students so far, more or less five at each universities. And it's a great group, from all undergrad, from physics, mechanical engineering, electrical engineering. So kind of all the diversity that you need to have in terms of background in a mission, and also student of colors, minority, first generation student, male, female.
Why is that so important, Noé, to NASA right now? Why is NASA saying, you know, Noé and Lugaz, help us out with this. Help us reach out to different communities who've been typically underrepresented, as you said, in astronomy and physics. Why is this important to NASA?
Well, I think there's this realization, I think that Nathan brought up before, is that we, We have to, United States is becoming a much more diverse place, so has become already a diverse place. And if we just rely on the traditional people in STEM, so in science and engineering, which happens to be primarily white male, we don't have much of a future in terms of space science and space industry. And it's really a problem throughout education, in terms of the pipeline for science and education, science and engineering education, that we have a hard time recruiting female and also minority students, hard time keeping them. And so because NASA just decided, we need to invest some money in this and some projects, just trying to broaden the pipeline, if you want. So bring more people in, keep more people in of not just 25% white male, but from the 100% of the US population.
Well, and as you guys know this better than me, when you broaden the different backgrounds of people who are working on a project, you sometimes get new approaches, new ideas, new ways of looking at things. If everybody is kind of from the same background, then you might have this sort of groupthink going on. So I wonder what you have seen with students, Noé, as you work with them on this cube satellite. Basically, I understand it's about the size of a box of milk. What is this little satellite going to do?
So very much things is happening with this project. Again, Howard University, for example, doesn't really have a space program that had some experiment on a rocket before. But so we see having fresh eyes from very different perspective is very useful. And so in this particular project, as you say, it's called a CubeSat. That's something kind of came up in the very late 90s, this idea of building a satellite on about a gallon milk size or less, and really started for kind of student education. And what we're trying to make unique in this project is, we didn't tell the student, oh, I want a CubeSat to do this particular thing and with this instrument and I'll build it. We told the student, okay, I want to go after understanding the upper atmosphere. So understanding kind of Earth's atmosphere at 600 miles or so, which is a region where you have now lots of satellites from like the SpaceX constellation, launching hundreds or even thousands of satellites in this kind of altitude. And so what we want to know is kind of learn how the atmosphere of Earth is there, because that's really going to affect the orbit of the satellites, how long they can stay in space, and of course, some of the radiation that Nathan mentioned also impact at this kind of altitude. So you can have effect on space instrument or space hardware in terms of the radiation. Wow. So we give them this project and now we tell them, please now come up with a design that we can go through the actual same type of reviews that a big mission will go through. That you're gonna have to prepare for thinking you're gonna go in front of NASA headquarters personnel and convince them that your design is gonna work, just not in a make-believe way, but in actual real way. That's a real mission, so you have to go through that phase as well. And I think that's a very educational part, and that's really where we need, even people with background in writing or educate, pretty much all through not only science engineering, but even beyond.
Well, and Nathan, to bring you back in for just a few last questions, and then we'll let both of you go. Noé mentioned, some of the challenges of the pandemic and how he's never met his students collaborating all online. How about you, Nathan? How has the pandemic affected your ability to work with students?
Well, it affects absolutely everything. It just makes everything harder. It takes longer. It has such a blanking effect on everything from ordering parts to, setting up interviews and discussions with students to keeping people on track. There's the broader psychological issue of everyone is feeling very isolated right now. And so it's hard to stay motivated. I gotta say, Noé is certainly, I've been working with him and watching him on the side, and he's doing a great job with his teams. He's keeping his teams together and our teams are doing a great job together. So the resilience of the people I work with is absolutely amazing.
Wow. It's been really interesting to hear from both of you, and I'd love to check back with you on these projects maybe a couple months down the road. But for now, Nathan, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Laura.
That's Nathan Schwadron, Professor of Physics at the UNH Space Science Center. And Noé, it was great to talk to you too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
That's Noé Lugaz, Research Associate Professor of Physics at UNH. Well, coming up, a Dartmouth scientist who studies auroras and why that matters, beyond how nice they are, of course, to see. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
For me, the decision to include NHPR in our estate was a very easy and simple one to make.
Karen and Dan Moran of Webster recently joined NHPR's Walter Peterson Legacy Society.
In filling out our will, basically, we made decisions about organizations that we wanted to support. So it's a very, very uncomplicated thing to do in many ways.
Find out how easy it is to include NHPR in your will or estate plans by emailing us at plangift@nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, in observation of the Shuttle Challenger disaster 35 years ago, we're honoring the legacy of those seven astronauts who died, including Concord teacher Krista McAuliffe, with an exploration of space science education going on right now in our state. You can join us too. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook, or you can call 800-892-6477. Well, we just heard from UNH. We're going to go now to Dartmouth College to talk to Christina Lynch. She's a professor of physics and astronomy there. Professor Lynch, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Laura. It's fun to be here with you.
So your work involves the study of auroras. Now, before we get into what you're looking at, just remind us briefly, please, what causes auroras and what they look like?
That wasn't on the list you sent me.
Oh, well, yeah, no, just a brief description of an aurora.
It's good. So I usually refer to them as the Northern Lights because that gives people a nice idea of what I'm talking about. And the basic mechanism is high-speed particles coming from nearer space into the neutral atmosphere and striking the gas of the atmosphere and making it glow. That's the basic element.
How many have you seen, Christina? I've heard they're pretty spectacular. I have not seen one.
Right. I do a lot of field work in northern Norway and in central Alaska. So in January or February, unless it's snowing, you see aurora most nights.
Wow. Most nights. That's amazing.
Yeah.
What colors have you seen? I've seen pictures, purple, green, and so forth.
Right. Yeah. Your eye needs to get dark adapted, and in which case your eye is an amazing instrument, right? Mm. And so if you can see the Milky Way, you can see the Northern Lights. The Northern Lights are brighter than the Milky Way. But if you can't see the Milky Way, it becomes difficult to see the Northern Lights. You need that level of darkness and clarity of sky.
Why is it important to know about these, beyond, again, that we all love to look at them?
Yeah. I mean, it's a basic understanding of how our environment works, which is, it's a beautiful laboratory for electricity and magnetism. But I think it's important to have a fundamental understanding of our world, and it's well described by electricity and magnetism. So if we can use the diagnostic of the visible aurora to understand our nearer space environment, well, that's a good thing. But, it's a privilege and a joy to spend your career studying the beautiful aspects of our world.
Right. Wow. Well, so as humans look to go to Mars, and we talked about this with our other guests, eventually, obviously down the line, how does your field of research help, Professor?
Right. So I did want to put in a pitch for a search on astronaut gateway aurora video, because that shows what the ISS astronauts see as they come across and see the aurora around our Earth, which they're hypnotizing. It's a black hole of time. but at any rate, our Earth has a strong dipolar magnetic field. That's why your compass works, right? There's an organized magnetic field structure to the Earth at large. And that's why the aurora are around our northern and southern poles. Mars has a very different magnetic structure than the Earth. It's not organized in that way. And so the work that I do about the northern lights and how they're organized by a magnetic field, you know, it transfers to places like Jupiter and Saturn, Neptune. It's a little scrambled on Mars.
Huh. And I'm going to put the aurora video that you mentioned, Professor mm-hmm. Lynch, on our website, nhpr.org/exchange, right. So people can look at it, because that sounds awesome.
There's many of them. Yeah, they're hypnotizing. Yeah.
Do other heavenly bodies, moons, planets have auroras, or are we the only one?
No, we're not special. and so, you know, the Earth is a bar magnet, just like in third grade with that little bar magnet and the iron filings, and you make those Mickey Mouse ears around the bar magnet. The Earth is a bar magnet, and it has that same kind of magnetic field structure around it. And that organizes the northern lights into circles around the poles. And so other planets that have an organized magnetic field will have the same, and an atmosphere will have the same effect. And so there are beautiful views of Jupiter, the aurora on Jupiter, on Uranus, on Neptune. One of my colleagues studies exoplanets, and I keep asking her, when are you going to show me an aurora picture from an exoplanet? You know, but
first you have to get the picture of the exoplanet.
Still pretty far away. Still kind of far away to see a picture like that. Yeah.
Wow. Well, you learn something new every day, and I did not mm-hmm. know that. So mm-hmm. thank you. How involved are students in your work, Professor Lynch?
Yeah, everything I do is because of my students. I think the joy of teaching is bringing students to do things they didn't know they could do. And I couldn't do what I do without my students. Our lab motto, we have lots of them. We alternate between them. You know, one of them is we build stuff. Another one is it should just work. And another one is everything takes longer than you think. And so yeah. I have a team of undergrads, usually two each year. So six or eight any given time, working 10 hours a week as a team. And they do everything from scut work as freshmen, you know, go buy 700 bolts up to work up under their own mentorship of the older students and my mentorship and my grad students to work up into senior thesis projects. I also have graduate students working with me. My baseline laboratory work is the NASA Sounding Rocket Program. And so CubeSats and satellites, they go around and around and around and around and around the Earth. They orbit and they stay up there. They're you know, large scale projects. Sounding rockets are 10-minute explorations of near Earth space. So we launch a rocket up into the northern lights and it radios information down and it comes back to the ground in 10, 15 minutes. And so with these projects, my students work to design and build and test and analyze. So when I get a new student in my lab, they shadow the rest of the group and we throw computational and mechanical and electrical and programming and science and physics and aurora, and we see what sticks. And everybody's got something that they find intriguing. Hmm. And it's fun to figure out, you know, what is the student going to echo with? What is that student going to work on?
Professor Lynch, you mentioned, you know, lab work, and obviously mm-hmm. that's so important. How has mm-hmm. the pandemic affected your ability to carry out that hands-on science that you're doing with students?
Right. So, you know, we've become Zoom aficionados. We're very tightly coupled. My group of 8 or 10, we meet multiple times every week, but it's all over Zoom. And so for this year, I've migrated almost all the students, certainly all the undergrads, towards tasks that they can work on remotely. They're still working as a team. This couple of students on this project, that couple of students on that project, but they're working with their computers and their pencils and papers rather than with soldering irons and nuts and bolts. I have two graduate students who are physically working in the lab, but the undergraduate team has completely moved to design and analysis projects. And there's so much to do, you know, there's always things to do, but we're all eager to get back into the physical.
Yeah, get those hands on, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's been good to talk to you, Professor Lynch, and we'll talk again. Thank you very much. I'm gonna check out those aurora videos too that you mentioned. So thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for having me here.
That's Christina Lynch. She's a Dartmouth College professor of physics and astronomy. Well, coming up, New Hampshire's own noisy astronomer joins us. Who is she? Well, keep it right here. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today is the 35th anniversary of the Challenger disaster, and we here on The Exchange are taking a moment to remember and honor Krista McAuliffe's legacy, who died that day along with six other astronauts, by shining a light on space education happening right now in our state. Exchange listeners, it's always good to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, comment on Facebook, or call 800-892-6477. Well, helping us finish out the show today is Nicole Gallucci, assistant professor of physics at St. Anselm College, also known as the noisy astronomer. Nicole, welcome back. Great to have you.
Hi, good to be with you.
So despite the restrictions of the pandemic, Nicole, as we have been hearing from our other guests, research continues. What are you working on right now with your students?
Yeah, so I am actually really excited to start up a new project with a group called the Pulsar Search Collaboratory. It's a project that uses radio astronomy data, and if you remember, I'm a big fan of radio telescopes, but it uses radio astronomy data to look for these objects called pulsars, which are really, 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 really dense cores of dead stars, and they've got little hot spots on them, and they rotate really rapidly. It's kind of like a lighthouse, so you see this blinking, but in the radio. And there's tons and tons and tons of data searching for this using particularly the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia. And the computer algorithms that look for them are okay, but you always need human verification to check afterwards. So the Pulsar Search Collaboratory set up a way that students can look through what has been flagged by the computer as a potential pulsar and contribute to research that way. So I'm looking to get that started. I just went to their workshop virtually a couple of weeks ago. And I'm adding that onto a project that I was working on with a senior before everything shut down, which is looking at double stars and tracking the orbits of double stars with time. So projects that are particularly geared for getting students interested in research who've had no background in research at all, and can jump into a project and start to learn not just the science, but the research process as well.
What is a double star, Nicole? That sounds cool.
Yeah, it's two stars orbiting each other. Double stars is two stars that are really, really close together as we see them. They may or may not actually be orbiting each other. Now, if they're a binary star, that means they're actually orbiting each other. And very often we see these close pairs of stars in our telescope images, but unless you track them over time to see, you know, how they're moving with respect to one another, in addition to other things like their distance from us and their motion, that tells us whether or not they're actually orbiting each other in a binary system. And binary systems are really important because that's the best way for us to understand the mass of a star. If we see a star out in space by itself, we really don't have a good way of judging its mass or measuring it directly.
How much has the pandemic affected your ability to engage with students, Nicole, to help them stay on the path that you want them to be on, to engage in that research that, you know, could be exciting?
It's been tough. Nate mentioned earlier, it's hard to connect. It's hard to stay motivated. I'm at a small college where teaching is my main responsibility, and teaching remotely switching to remote teaching became the biggest thing that I've been working on the past few months. So it's been tough. And so I'm hoping that, you know, getting folks involved in a project that isn't, you know, too mathematically or computationally intensive, something that we can get together and look at together over Zoom, will help bring people together. And just as they were mentioning earlier, these students doing projects virtually, we did have a student who got into a summer research program last summer. And although many of them were canceled because you couldn't travel to labs to do work, thankfully in astronomy, if you're using your computer, you don't need to actually travel somewhere. So we have a student, Emma Goulet, who just did some astronomy research with a professor in Connecticut and presented her research at a virtual conference just a couple weeks ago. So it's this bizarre reality where folks are doing the same work, but, you know, doing it over Zoom, doing it from, from their home office.
We talked earlier in the show, and I know you were listening, Nicole, with a UNH professor, Noe, who's working with students, not just at UNH, but several other colleges and universities to engage with students who are underrepresented, as he said, in the fields of physics and space science. What are you seeing or working on in this area, Nicole?
Yeah, that's something that has been very important to me. Last year, right before the pandemic really broke, the American Institute of Physics put out a really nice detailed study, specifically the experiences of Black undergraduate students in physics, because the number of Black students getting degrees in physics is ridiculously low. And it picked out, you know, some of the important factors, the things that were driving, you know, students who love physics away from the field. And it's got a whole list of things that the field as a whole can do and things that the department can do. And so at St. Anselm, we're taking a close look at that report because we want to expand our program, but we want to make sure as we expand our program that we are involving everyone who loves physics or astronomy, who wants to get a chance to do this kind of science. So that's what we're doing locally to bring, you know, really make science accessible, bring in everyone, who's like Noe said earlier, everyone's got a little something different to contribute.
Yeah, why do you think it's important beyond, you know, obviously every college university wants to bring in more people to their programs, but more philosophically or academically, Nicole, why is it important to widen the circle of people who are involved in space science research?
Sure. For me, it's just on the one level, it's the right thing to do. it's not, you know, that's the most succinct way. It's just the right thing to do. But looking at it more broadly, science is a human endeavor, and science is influenced by what ideas, what experiences we've had that we bring to it. And when science is only done by a certain subset of people, as it has more or less for the last 500 years, that limits what we can do. That limits how much we can understand. There are so many ways of knowing and so many different ways of looking at the universe that had they been incorporated from the beginning, I think science would have been even further along than it is now. So bringing people in is going to make it a truly holistic human endeavor that it's meant to be.
Wow. Well, we could talk about that for another 20 minutes, probably, Nicole, but I have a couple more questions to ask you. One is about the change in the White House and how it might affect space research. The Planetary Society had this to say about the Trump administration, that it leaves Joe Biden, quote, a NASA on the cusp of a great and exciting decade with strong funding for science, a clear set of well-crafted space policies, and new hardware, nearly, ready to carry humans beyond Earth for the first time in half a century. So, Nicole, the Trump administration did have this Artemis project, which you and I have talked about before, to get sort of regular trips to the moon going as part of a warm-up act to get people to Mars. What are you hearing now about the Biden White House, Nicole, and how much it might continue these policies?
So it's interesting. NASA funding and as well National Science Foundation funding tends to be pretty popular across the aisle. You know, spaceflight and science are things that are very important. And science is going to be very important to the Biden administration as well. Granted, they are very focused on vaccine science and virus science, as that's absolutely crucial now. But I think this growth will continue throughout the administration for both of these. My looking at the NASA budget, there was a lot of money put towards science project. Not as much, this is Congress's input, not as much in the Artemis program as was asked for. They were leaning more towards the robotic space missions in the NASA budget.
And telescopes, that's interesting.
Large telescopes.
Yeah. So Congress, the Trump administration, definitely interested in getting footprints on the moon again, mm-hmm. you know, to lead up to footprints on Mars. And you're saying Congress, Republicans and Democrats, Nicole, were a little less interested in that, more interested in just getting more hardware up there.
Yeah, I don't know how it broke down by party, but the way the budget came out, they definitely pulled back a little bit, I think, on the human spaceflight side.
What would you like to see happen in the new year, Nicole, if you, New Hampshire's noisy astronomer, could just make it so? And yes, I'm quoting Captain Picard there.
Yes.
Go ahead. What would you like to see happen in the new year, Nicole?
No more virus would be awesome, because that really affects everything.
Right. We heard that from our other guests, too. It's just so hard to conduct research and engage with students. But in terms of astronomical discoveries or improvements.
Yeah, so one thing I'm really looking forward to is the planned launch of the James Webb Space Telescope. And I have been around long enough that I remember the launch date of the James Webb Space Telescope being possibly 2012. This project is massive, and it's been pushed back because of in part how massive and intricate it is. But this is a large infrared telescope. It's gonna be the successor to Hubble. And they've already went through the first call for proposals for astronomers to actually use the telescope, even though it hasn't launched yet. So I'm really looking forward to that coming out, to that science being accessible. And what I'd really like to see, of course, is a lot more focus. Again, you have to get rid of the virus first.
Right.
But, focus and support for science education in general. Something that someone said earlier, I think it was Nate. One of the things I do is I teach an astronomy 101 course to students from any major. And exposing people to science and exposing people to astronomy and the wonders of science through that, for some of them, that's the last science class that they ever take. So I really try to focus on that, not just nurturing the students who want to become scientists, but those students who are going to go on to do all kinds of other things in their lives to appreciate science and particularly how it's done. To do that, I would love to get more people at the observatory actually looking through a telescope, which is why COVID has to go away.
Yeah, right. It's hard to get people excited when, if they're not directly wanting to be an astronomer anyway, but if you can get their eyes on a telescope, it does make a difference. Speaking of observatories, what about the, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Arecibo Observatory that collapsed? That's something else that I know is on your wish list for 2021, Nicole.
Oh, gosh, yes. Yes. So the Arecibo radio telescope, if you've been, watching there, it suffered a devastating collapse in December after the initial problem with the cable that put a hole in the dish. It was devastating. It's the only thing I can think of. So this has been discussed most recently at the American Astronomical Society meeting. And a lot of folks want to see Arecibo rebuilt, not just because it has technology and capabilities that no other telescope has, but also because it has such an important cornerstone of science in Puerto Rico, science and engineering. This is something that a lot of the Puerto Rican astronomers I follow and chat with on Twitter were just, this is a part of their heart. So I know that the Puerto Rican governor has pledged money towards rebuilding, but it was also discussed that Congress has asked, as well as astronomers have asked the observatory for an update, and what the NSF, the National Science Foundation, is willing to do to bring an observatory back at that site. So we'll probably hear that by the end of February. It's still up in the air. But yeah, seeing Arecibo rebuilt and seeing it get the priority that it deserves would be a really nice gift in 2021.
So it's in Puerto Rico, and mm-hmm. it sounds like it has unique capabilities.
Yes.
So that's number one on your list. Also getting that James Webb telescope up there. Number two on your list. I know we'll be checking back with you probably in a couple months, Nicole, when we talk to our sky crew. But for now, thank you very much for being with us. I really appreciate it.
I hope to see you in person. I've got a great new skirt with Saturn's rings on it. You have to see.
Yes, Nicole also has an impressive array of sky-related clothing, jewelry, maybe even a tattoo. Nicole, it's good to talk to you. Thank you.
Good to talk to you, Laura.
Bye-bye. That's Nicole Gallucci, assistant professor of physics at St. Anselm College. You can find her on Twitter and elsewhere as the Noisy Astronomer. Today's show was produced by NHPR News host and Exchange producer Jessica Hunt. Thanks for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.